It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegfright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
Also in both cases, we got settlements within a month on one, and then the other one was less than 2 months, from talking to the client to getting the check in the bank. I think that's a pretty fast result.
Private attorney James Boykin explains how to make mandatory consumer arbitration work for and not against the consumer, and the tricky issue of how to recover your vacation pay from your former employer, if you're even owed it at all, is explained during this week's question and answer session. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 115, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. In the U.S., there now is more student loan debt than credit card debt. But unlike credit card debt, student loan debt almost never can be discharged in a bankruptcy. But relief still is possible. Federal law sets forth at least 9 reasons why a student loan can be canceled or forgiven. These include the borrower's total and permanent disability, school closure before you completed your studies, inability to benefit from the school, a forged signature, a school's failure to pay a tuition refund, and various loan forgiveness for public service employees and teachers. If you have a problem with your student loan, you first need to call your loan servicer. If you don't know who's servicing your loan, you can use the National Student Loan Data System or call 1-800-4-FED-AID. If you can't resolve the problem yourself, you can contact the Federal Student Aid Ombudsman of the Department of Education at ombudsman.ed.gov. Just remember that first you must make every effort to resolve your student loan problem yourself, and only contact the ombudsman when you have done all you can do yourself and still haven't been able to reach a solution. Again, that's ombudsman.ed.gov. In other news, the Affordable Care Act made important improvements to the Medicare Part D program that will make prescription drugs more affordable for people with Medicare who enter the coverage gap or donut hole in their prescription drug coverage. These changes are popular among Medicare beneficiaries and for good reason. Prior to the passage of the Affordable Care Act, people with Medicare who reached the donut hole were required to cover 100% of the cost of their prescription medications until they reached the catastrophic coverage limit. This put a significant and undue financial burden on many seniors and people with disabilities. Over time, the Affordable Care Act will bring much-needed economic relief to millions of Medicare beneficiaries. Families USA has created 4 tools online to help people with Medicare navigate the new Medicare Coverage Gap Discount Program, including Help in the Donut Hole, the Medicare Coverage Gap Discount Program, which explains the coverage gap and the different features of the Coverage Gap Discount Program. This includes answers to commonly asked questions. For more information, go to www.familiesusa.org. With this week's news you can use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You are listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week, we introduce a new segment called Cases That Changed the Commonwealth. This week's case that changed the Commonwealth is Anderson versus Denny. Beatrice Anderson and Barbara Long were federally subsidized housing tenants in Charlottesville, Virginia. Their landlord sued to evict them under state law. Virginia law allows an eviction without cause, which would include the mere expiration of the tenancy. But in 1973, the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Virginia ruled that federally subsidized tenants were entitled to greater protection and could not be evicted unless and until they received notice alleging good cause, and good cause to evict was proven in a hearing in state court. Tenants in subsidized housing still enjoy this protection. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and Anderson versus Denny is this week's Case That Changed the Commonwealth.
You are listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. It's time for this week's question and answer. We're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Please tell us your name and where you're from.
Hello, my name is Vanessa, and I'm from Richmond.
Welcome to the show, Vanessa. What are we talking about this week?
Well, what I want to know is, I recently left a job that I felt was in threat, and I never received my vacation pay. So I contacted the office, and they told me I was only going to receive half of my vacation pay because I didn't give them a 2 weeks notice. But I never received anything at all. And what I want to know is, do they have a right to keep my vacation pay?
Well, Vanessa, that's a really good question. And unlike wages that you worked for and that you actually earned, vacation pay is a little bit murkier. It's really a matter of what agreement there is between you and your employer. There's nothing in the Code of Virginia that says that you're entitled to vacation pay. It's really a matter of contract. It's a matter of the agreement between you and your employer. Now, most people who work don't have employment contract like you have a contract to buy a car or a lease to rent a house. A lot of the contracts are just oral, verbal, spoken contracts. Very difficult to prove. Now, sometimes you can show an agreement by a personnel manual. The problem is that a lot of personnel manuals say they're purely advisory and they don't really give you any legally enforceable rights. So the best thing that you've got here right now is your employer's statement to you that they would pay you half of your vacation pay. That statement, it seems to me, is an acknowledgement of a verbal contract between you and your employer that if you did leave, that you would be entitled to at least half of your vacation pay, even if you left without the 2 weeks' notice. That sounds good enough to take the case to court. And again, I always advise in these situations for people to go into the small claims division of the General District Court. You can file there on your own, by yourself, without an attorney. No lawyers are allowed. Your first court date is your trial date. You simply say your piece to the judge. The other side says their piece. The judge hears you both and makes a decision. Now, as the plaintiff, you do have the burden of proof. So if you say that there was this agreement and they say it wasn't and you can't show anything to break that tie, you may lose. But on the other hand, all you have to lose really is your filing fee, which is $40 or $50 some, and you can even fill out a form at the general district court to file the case for free, and the judge can let you file for free. So other than your own time, you really have very little to lose. So I certainly think it's worth going for, because, you know, if the employer makes a statement like that, they ought to stick to it. And if they don't stick to it, then you should take them to court and say your piece to the judge. Is this helpful to you?
Yes, thank you very much.
All right, take care. Buy a car, change cell phone plans, or open a new credit card, and you'll likely be required to sign a lengthy contract that requires mandatory consumer arbitration instead of the courts to settle disputes. Private attorney James Boykin explains how to make mandatory arbitration work for and not against the consumer.
My name's James Boykin. I practice at Hughes Hubbard & Reed in Washington, D.C. I'm a six-year associate there. When I started there, I basically started doing international arbitration and commercial arbitration. And I somewhat, through an odd sequence of events, got involved with consumer arbitration. It happened, Robin Edwards from Central Virginia Legal Aid and I knew each other, and she called me one day and said, "Jim, you know, I have this case. Looks like this company, this debt negotiation firm, really ripped off this poor elderly woman for a lot of money, but they've got this arbitration clause in the contract. How do I get around it?" And I think what I told her was, don't get around it, embrace it, and, you know, turn the tables on them. And since that first case, we've done another using similar principle of embrace the arbitration clause. And it sort of came out that she suggested that I come talk about how you could make an arbitration work for the consumer, because we've now done it twice with really terrific results, where we've got in very early stages of the proceedings. The latest we ever got in proceedings was a procedural conference with the arbitrator, and we got settlements of four times the client's actual damages. So, I mean, you know, we had statutes with leverage for attorney's fees if we got to the merits. So, I mean, there's some reason why they would pay more. But also in both cases, we got settlements within a month on one, and then the other one was less than 2 months from, you know, talking to the client to getting the check in the bank. And I think that's a pretty fast result. Now, I mean, perhaps you guys have, you know, sometimes swifter results, and some of the cases I deal with, it, you know, yeah, I just finished one arbitration that took 5 years, but that's a huge commercial case. That's not a consumer case. And I admit, I come to these consumer cases with a bit of, you know, coming from the sort of international and more commercial context. But I think you can take a lot out of that context and make it work for the consumer. So that's sort of what I'm here to talk about today. My goal here today is to challenge what is clearly a widely held perception that it's arbitration is unfair to the consumer. I'm going to concede, though, before I get into this, that arbitration clauses are not in contracts out of benevolence. They're there for one primary reason. I mean, there's a number of reasons, but it's my belief they're there for one primary reason, which is to limit class action lawsuits. That's why they're there. That's why companies like them. Other reasons are the private nature of the dispute. And here I want to harp on what is a hobby horse of mine. Arbitration is private. It's not confidential. That means you're not, and the distinction I'm making here, and I know this one speaks to your experience, is there's not a legal obligation to stay silent about what happens in the arbitration. It just means the general public can't go into the conference room and watch the proceeding. That's the privacy. And don't let anybody ever bully you around and tell you you have a duty of confidentiality, because you don't. The way I look at this, it's the principle of judo. You got to use your opponent's aggression against them. They've put this clause in there for a reason, not a benevolent one. Turn the tables, use it against them. That's what we're going to talk about. Your basic broad arbitration agreement. You agree that any claim or dispute between you and company or against either party's agents, employees, successors, or assigned shall be resolved by binding arbitration, whether such dispute is related to this agreement or otherwise, including the validity of this arbitration agreement. It's a broadly worded clause under the FAA that gets everything in front of the arbitrator, including fraud and the inducement. So you're faced with that. What do you do? That's just the basic clause, but you might have in it, it might reference some rules. It might have onerous provisions, like the consumer's got to travel to Timbuktu. The company has a right to appeal, but the consumer doesn't. There may be all sorts of provisions in there that you don't like. And what I want to draw your attention to is this one case, Hooters v. Phillips, because it's a Fourth Circuit case. It defines the outer contours of what anybody can get away with. It's extreme, so, and you may not always be confronted with the extreme, but you know, look at what this arbitration agreement required. It required the employee to provide the company notice of the claim at the outset, the nature of the claim, and the specific acts or omissions. Hooters doesn't have to give notice of any defenses. So you have to put in your claim, but Hooters doesn't have to answer. And I'll back up. This was a sexual harassment lawsuit. I know everybody's shocked. The employee was required, at the same time they put in their statement, to list and name all their fact witnesses, say what they're going to testify to, and you know how they know the facts they're going to testify to. Hooters didn't have to identify any witnesses. The rules gave Hooters complete control over who would be on the arbitration panel, all three arbitrators. Hooters could expand or add claims at any time. The employee was entirely limited to that first document that the employee filed. And then Hooters could move for summary judgment in front of the arbitrators. The employee could not. They had to actually go to a hearing. And then Hooters could appeal. And this is what the court held. By promulgating this system of warped rules, Hooters so skewed the process in its favor that Phillips has been denied arbitration in any meaningful sense of the word. To uphold the promulgation of this aberrational scheme under the heading of arbitration would undermine, not advance, the federal policy favoring alternative dispute resolution. This we refuse to do. So you have an outer boundary line where all of these abusive practices have been held to basically not be arbitration. So now, how do you get in front of one of these institutions that are fair when the agreement references, if it references one of them, great, start there and then go red pencil out all the unfavorable things. Let the AAA do that work for you by refusing to administer the arbitration. But what if the clause is silent? Doesn't specify an institution. I think the same analysis applies. I think what you want to do is you just go and you start with the AAA. And what the AAA will do is they'll send a letter to the business asking the business to consent to arbitration administered by the AAA. And the business refuses to consent because we didn't agree to AAA. But the clause is silent, so what did they agree to? And maybe there's all sorts of onerous provisions in the arbitration clause. Then sue them for what you want to sue them in circuit court, and let them come into court and invoke the arbitration clause. And then you say, we already tried. They don't want to arbitrate, at least in front of the AAA. And, you know, we speculate the reasons are because the due process protocols, they can't have these provisions that they want. All they want to do is push us into a kangaroo court. I mean, you can let the other, you don't want to be that aggressive, but let the other side have to explain to the judge why it is they don't want to go to the leading arbitration institution in the United States to arbitrate their claims after you have already tried to start it. Here are some of what I felt were the key provisions of the Consumer Due Process Protocol. That's the AAA's version of these minimum standards. I think all of them are important, but I highlighted a few of them that I want to talk about. And I think the most important one is Principle 6, reasonable cost. Now, why do I think this one's the most important? It's because this is where your real leverage comes in to get a settlement. I've basically put up the principle there. It was, but this is how it works. Now, that principle was implemented in Rule C8 of the Supplementary Procedures for Consumer-Related Disputes. This is my one criticism of it. It gets a little bit confusing because in a consumer arbitration, you've got four rules that are applying. You have, if the clause is silent, you're going to have the AAA's standard commercial rules. If it's a consumer case, which they define as basically any arbitration agreement in a contract of adhesion, to which the other party had no meaningful right to adjust it, then you get the supplementary procedures for consumer-related disputes. Then there's the expedited procedures if your claim is less than $10,000. And then there's the consumer due process protocol sort of sitting on top of everything. So there's sort of four documents. Now, this is how Rule C8 works, and it's the implementation of this Principle 6. If the claim is under $10,000, the consumer pays $125 to file. That $125 is considered an advance on the arbitrator's fee. The consumer never pays another dime. If it's above, if it's between $10,000 and $75,000, the consumer pays $375, and that goes towards one half of the arbitrator's fee, and the consumer never pays anything after that. If it's above $75,000, it's going to be split evenly, and it's going to be the sliding scale of the commercial rules. So if it's a big claim, you could actually, in that case, be having to advance more substantial sums. But if we're talking claims under $75,000, that's a very modest filing fee. I tried to compare it. I think I've got some of my comparisons here. I looked up what cost of filing a complaint in circuit court for Richmond claiming $50,000 for breach of contract. It was $234. And, you know, so at the AAA, you'd be paying $375. So it's a little more expensive. If you filed a complaint in circuit court for Richmond of less than $50,000 for breach of contract, your filing fee is $124. At the AAA, it's $125. So it's a dollar more expensive for the consumer. But there's other savings too, because you're not going to have to serve process. You're not going to have all the formalities that are attendant to jurisdiction in a circuit court. And I think the efficiency, the informality of the process leads to some ancillary cost savings there too. But just to kick off the ball, is for claims of less than $50,000 the same as kicking off the ball in circuit court? And in court, defendants don't have an obligation to file a fee to answer. Well, in front of the AAA, they do. On a claim of less than $10,000, they have to pay $775 and the other half of the arbitrator's fee. So they have to pay the $775 of the AAA's administrative fee plus the other $125 to the arbitrator. So they're paying a total on that first tier, and I left off the 125, or it comes on the next slide. But basically, they have to then, to have the AAA register the arbitration, they have to pay $900. If they don't do it, if they just ignore you, you can go to court. You've tried to arbitrate and they refused. So depending on the value of your claim, you know, they have to, and what happens is you send this in, within 1 or 2 days, they send it to the business respondent, and they give the respondent 2 weeks to pay. And if they don't pay it, then the AAA is also not going to administer further arbitrations from them. And so you basically put a gun to their head, depending on the amount of the claim at issue. They have to very quickly make an analysis of, do we pay to play or do we just settle? So you've already got, just by filing the complaint, some negotiation leverage. And that goes up, because at the $10,000 to $75,000 level, they've got to pay $975. And then they got to pay the other $375 for the other half of the arbitrator's fee. So you're up at, I think, $1,350. And then they also have to, in either case, pay fees for the hearing. So there's this cost-shifting provision that essentially forces the business to pay for the entire proceeding. And this is the beauty, too, is because the consumer's filing fee was a deposit against arbitrator fees. If you settle before the arbitrator gets involved, you get it all back. And Rob and I, in both cases, have gotten all of our filing fee back. So it essentially costs the consumer nothing to start the arbitration, get the leverage they needed to get somebody's attention, and get a settlement.
Private attorney James Boykin explains how to make mandatory consumer arbitration work for and not against the consumer.
This week's Strange But True Law is from Title 2.2, which deals with the administration of government.
This includes Virginia's Freedom of Information Act, which generally requires that public records be made available within 5 working days of a request. But Code of Virginia 2.2-3702 goes one step further and requires that any person elected, reelected, appointed, or reappointed to any body covered by the Act to be given a copy of the Act within 2 weeks following elections, reelections, appointment, or reappointment, and to read and become familiar with the Act. So, if any government official covered by the Freedom of Information Act violates it, they also violated it a second time by not knowing about it. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and that's this week's Strange But True Law.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. If you want to end your rental housing lease early, it's not as easy as you think. Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when our guest, private attorney Charles Adams, describes the perils and pitfalls of ending your lease early, as well as the few ways to do so legally. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.
My Lord.